Gary Hansen of Acton. Let's talk.
Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is Thursday, April 17th, 2003, and we're continuing our public hearing on House Bill 5009, which is the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development budget. Members, if I might make a note here, we've had a request that when we speak, that we speak loudly and into our microphones because people are having difficulty hearing what we say. So in consideration of having the discussion be heard by all, please speak up. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5009. And Mr. Bender, if you would do the preliminaries, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Today we'll begin the Community College Support Fund by the agency, including how the monies are distributed and impacts of recent cuts in the fund in funding on the community colleges. Before we begin, I just have responses to a couple questions that members had yesterday, and then the department will have responses to additional questions that you had yesterday. If you look at the material that was distributed to you today, immediately beneath your agenda, you should see a sheet that looks like this that includes unemployment rates. This is in response to Senator Messerly's question, who wanted some information on unemployment rates throughout the state. If you do look at that, I don't want to spend too much time on this, except to say that that first column shows unemployment rates in year 2000, which was the year in Oregon where unemployment bottomed out at the end of the last boom. And then the most recent figures that are available are in the middle. That's for the month of February 2003. If you look, you can see these are categorized. These are in order from the most distressed county to the least distressed county. So the unemployment rate declines as you go down this list. And I've categorized them into different groups. The first group, if you're looking in the left column, those four all have unemployment rates over 9%. The next group is 7 to 9%. The third group is 5 to 7%. And those bottom five counties, and you see the second to the last one, Portland, Vancouver, those are actually the counties of Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Columbia. All of those, plus Clark County in Washington, because that's how the Department of Labor reports this, those all had unemployment rates of under 5%. And the middle column, unfortunately, shows the distress that this recession is having in Oregon, I think, very well, because now the above 9% category has half of the counties instead of just four of them. The next set are all 7 to 9% unemployment. And then there's only one county left in the entire state that has an unemployment rate below 7%, and that's Benton County. So you can see things have, in terms of the employment picture, have deteriorated markedly. This is probably overstressing that deterioration, luckily, though, because February is a month that traditionally has very high unemployment. And if we average it out for the whole year of 2003, hopefully the numbers will be less. Also, as another, on the right, it just shows how it's changed over these 3 years, the unemployment rate. On the flip side of this is another measure of regional variations in economic prosperity. This is the figure for per capita personal income. And these counties are also ranked in order, but here the top is, you want to be at the top of the list, whereas on the other side of the page, you wanted to be at the bottom of the list. This shows per capita personal income varying from $34,500 in Clackamas County in year 2000, which is the latest we have available, down to a level of only $14,476 in Sherman County. I'd be happy to go into and respond to any questions if you have them.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, isn't it true that another factor that we don't consider when we look at the unemployment rates is that some of these communities are losing their workforce, and an indicator to me on that is that the enrollment in the K-12 schools is decreasing rapidly. And wouldn't that skew the unemployment rate? As you lose workforce, you have less people that are on the roll?
The unemployment rate is defined as being the percentage of people who are in the labor force. That is to say, they would like to be working, but they don't currently have a job. So if the people who would otherwise be in that category are leaving the county to go elsewhere to find work, in that sense, the unemployment rate may be underrepresenting the stress there, because those people aren't being counted. They've given up, essentially, looking for work in that area and have moved somewhere else.
Thank you.
The other item, which I've distributed, was at Representative Bates's request. He asked that you receive the actual numbers behind a chart, which we looked at the first day of taking up this particular budget. That was looking at the community colleges themselves. At the bottom of this page here, you can see that's the chart we looked at on Tuesday, which shows the three major funding sources that community colleges use to finance their operations: the state general fund, their tuition revenue, and the property taxes. This is a system-wide total of the funds that are available. And Representative Bates asked for the actual numbers behind this chart, and those are shown on the table at the top of this page. You can see that this is showing those first four columns after the fiscal year are dollar amounts. These are all annual figures. They are not biennial, because community colleges do budget on an annual basis. The first column shows what's been happening to state support that's distributed through the Community College Support Fund. You can see that peaked in the year 2001-02, where it was $220 million. And the projection, under the governor's balanced budget proposal, is that for each of the 2 years of the upcoming biennium, that number would be $199 million. If you add the district taxes in the next column plus the tuition, you get the fourth column, which is shaded, and that is the total amount of revenues that the community colleges have. As you recall, when we were looking at the OUS budget, we talked about the limited education and general budget, which was there to general fund and tuition and fees. This is the comparable figure for community colleges. It's their general fund plus the tuition and fees, plus also the property taxes that they receive. And you can see that number there. It's harder looking at these numbers to see what's going on just looking at the numbers themselves. So to the right of that shaded column, all of these are annual percentage changes. So these are the changes from the prior year. If we look then at the state column, we can see that there were periods of time when there were very large increases on an annual basis in state support for community colleges. For example, if you look at 94-95 and 95-96, at the same time, this was when Measure 5 was phasing in, so the district taxes on those same years were dropping. I would now refer to the shaded column on the right. These are the percentage changes associated with the shaded column in the middle. This is the total funding. And you can see what's been happening here. The current year that we are in is the year 2002-03, and this year the actual total revenues available are down about 2%. It's the only time during this period where there's been an actual dollar decline in revenue. Of course, the costs to the colleges are affected by not only inflation, but it also increases in enrollments. So this doesn't account for that. This is just saying, even not considering inflation or enrollment changes, the actual dollars available went down 1.95%. Finally, the column to the right, which isn't a complete column, but has a numbers sticking out. These are biennialized, just to get us back into gear looking at biennia as we do with the state budget. The number at the very bottom right, which says 2.7%, what that reflects is the amount of total revenues that community colleges are projected to have under the governor's balanced budget in 2003-04 compared to what they had during the current biennium after the Measure 5 reductions. Not the Measure 5, excuse me, the Special Session 5 reduction, those reductions. This compares to growth rates in the past. You can see what was happening in past biennia as you go up. So the one before that was the change between, this biennium and the biennium prior, et cetera. Let me, in final comment, say that these tuition numbers, especially the projections, are subject, they are just speculative as to what the actual tuition dollars that the 17 community colleges will collect actually will be, since that depends not only on the rates that they charge, but also on the enrollments. Are there any questions?
Questions or comments?
A comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Steve, thank you for putting this together. For me, it puts it in a better perspective and something I can get my hands around better, and I appreciate you doing the effort of doing this. It also points out that with the lack of state funding we've seen and knowing that community colleges have increased energy costs, they have increased enrollment, they have increases in personnel costs they have no control over, they've been forced to raise revenue, and as they've raised that revenue, obviously that affects what their population looks like as far as who can afford to go. It affects their ability to offer sections and courses, and that, in essence, limits the number of kids can go and adults that can go to community colleges also. I repeat myself, I know, by saying that community colleges, to me, are where a lot of our middle-income and low-income people go to get their education because they can't afford OUS, and now we're making this unaffordable for them also. And so I appreciate the work you've done. It makes it a perspective I can understand. I understand why they've raised the tuition. I understand better why the number of students going in is declining because of the cost run-up they have no control over, and we have not helped them out holding up our end of the bargain here. Thank you.
The Representative Bates, I appreciate your comments, and I think I also appreciate the work that Mr. Bender's done to bring this to us, because I think it is the kind of overview that gives us a good perspective on what the challenges are in the system. And clearly, because of the revenue situation that we find ourselves in, are going to be challenged in this area, and especially dealing with the enrollment growths and the subsequent tuition increases. And there are, I think, cost drivers that also have an impact on this. One of them being PERS has a big impact on what's pushing the cost into this. Another one being healthcare. And those are things that we need to keep in mind as we have our discussions here, because those may be areas where we can have some impact. Further questions or comments? Representative March.
There's been some talk about reduction in self-improvement classes, and I wonder if we have any information on the numbers that reduced in terms of enrollment as well.
We have community college presidents on our agenda today, and I think that would be a great question to ask them.
Thanks.
Further questions or comments? Mr. Bender, do you have further information for us? Then I will call forward Ms. Pruse-Brawley to continue with the presentation, and I'm assuming that the first thing you're going to do is answer a bunch of questions for us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Cam Pruse-Brawley with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Yes, you should have a letter in front of you that answers two of the questions that were raised yesterday, and we have incorporated the funding formula questions into our presentation. The first question we'd like to respond to is the one brought to us by Senator Gordley. Not Representative Gordley, as the letter so indicates.
We appreciate you giving her the promotion.
But Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, our sincere apologies. We actually do know that you are a senator.
Are you moving into my district?
You can take that up after the discussion is over today.
Well, actually, we are really very confused because later in the letter we correct ourselves and identify her as a senator. The question, however, was raised around what was going to happen to the 40 one-stop workforce career centers given the state of the budget. And you have three paragraphs there that essentially say we don't yet know. We don't yet know exactly what state general fund will, how this general fund reductions will impact the career one-stops. We don't believe that any will actually close. We do think that there will be a reduction of service because the backbone, as I said yesterday, of these career centers is the federal WIA workforce resources. But at this time, it's difficult to say what shape they will be in when we finish the budget.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon. Thank you, and I do appreciate the response. And just an FYI for you, Cam, and for the committee, I had the opportunity to meet with Senator Gordon Smith yesterday and brought to his attention this issue and the loss of the $3 million to this budget. And he's taking note of that, and you can look forward to having a conversation.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, thank you very much. The second item is a response again to Senator Gordley regarding a detailed and aggressive affirmative action plan. We found ourselves unable to adequately respond in the time available. We'll bring that back on Monday.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, with your permission, I would like to ask Brett West, who is the Assistant Commissioner for Community Colleges, to join me at the table today. He is our walking font of knowledge about all things around funding formulas. I didn't mean to set you up too much, but the pressure is now on. Today we are going to discuss the support fund distribution formula and its implementation as Senator Meserly requested. We'll then move on to our support fund request and the implications of that request and options that we find available to us. And we'll finish with some testimony from three community college presidents about the impact at the local community level. I would like to begin by just bringing to the attention of the committee the community college statutory mission. It is fairly lengthy. I wanted to just bring to your attention a couple of things. In the first paragraph, community college is intended to fill the institutional gap by offering education that is broad and comprehensive, academic as well as professional technical. It is designed primarily to provide associate and certificate degree programs, serving those in transition, those who want to continue for a baccalaureate, provide ability to enter the workforce, and to serve the future educational needs of other students. It does provide a means for a continuation of academic education, professional technical training, and attainment of entirely new skills as demands for old skills and old occupations are supplanted by new technology. We are also directed to provide a means to coordinate courses and programs with high schools to enhance the certificate of advanced mastery and to accommodate successful transition to college degree programs. We felt it was important to bring all of this statement to you, although it is fairly...
Can I interrupt with a question here? Given this is your statutory mission, can you just take a couple of minutes and talk to the committee about how the personal development classes got into the mix here?
Madam Chair, absolutely. Self-improvement courses are provided as an educational entryway for many students, as well as a community service. One community college did conduct a study about what became of or what was the transition of students who availed themselves to self-improvement courses on that campus, and one out of four actually continued on in and was a successful community college student.
I'm not talking about things like remedial reading and remedial math and skill building. I'm talking about things like mushroom identification and learning how to play bridge and, you know, those kinds of things.
Madam Chair, the courses that you have just identified fall under the category of hobby and recreation,
okay.
And they are provided primarily on through the college campus on as a self-support. That means that they don't receive general fund. They are pay-as-you-go coursework and not reimbursed by the state.
Representative March, is this where you were wanting to go?
I was just curious about whether there was some decline. What we were seeing in decline in numbers had anything to do with the decline in any of the self-improvement and or other classes.
And by self-improvement, what kind of classes are you talking about?
I was using a category that had been mentioned here, so I hadn't fully defined it myself.
Either. Okay, thank you. Please proceed. I think we'll just kind of peck away at this as we go.
All right. You want to? Thanks. I'm going to move on to slide three, about which addresses the State Board of Education. It has the statutory authority to govern Oregon's community college districts. As part of that responsibility, they do have authority to develop and implement a formula for the distribution of the state resources that we receive from the legislature, and it does develop the formula within a policy framework of on slide number four, access and equity. Access is defined by the board currently as all Oregonians should have access to community college services regardless of where they live. The way this policy has been implemented is that as communities who were not part of a community college district, for example, River County or Klamath County, as they decided that they wanted to have a community college district and actually took the question to their voters, the State Board of Education helped support both the development of the ballot title and public information for the community so that they would know what they would receive as they join the family of Oregon's community colleges. So access is not just defined by ensuring that students are available or have access where community college districts already exist, but also where they may not exist. I will have to pause here and tell you that right now we do not anticipate more annexations. That's the term when you add territory to a district. Right now we have portions of eight of Oregon's community colleges that are outside a district, but they are the most rural and most sparsely populated areas of Oregon. And they are served by contracts out of district through colleges that are closest to them.
Representative March.
Thank you. So the contracts provide that the county that the student comes from, if they're not in the district, they would pay a certain amount to the district to school that individual?
Yes, Chair Morgan, Representative March, that's correct. It does provide service. The second policy area is equity. Each college, and the board's policy, they believe that each college should receive the same funding per student. And the last one is quality, and this is a fairly new element of policy for the State Board of Education, and it was will be affirmed likely tomorrow when the State Board meets, but they have adopted a freeze on enrollments, and that's primarily to stop the erosion of the dollar value for each student served, because the more you pour in to the top of the funnel, the less you pay for each one. Yeah.
Senator Masrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to equity. How do you define that? Is that equity of state funds or equity of total funds per student? And if so, when was that policy developed?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, we define it as both state resources and a recognition of the property tax resources from the district, and we'll get into that in some detail.
Okay.
And you had a question also on the time frame when this policy was developed.
Are you going to get into that?
Yes. Yes, sir. As usual, you are just a couple of steps ahead of me.
Sorry.
Slide 5 does begin the direct conversation about the funding formula. It was the passage of Ballot Measure 5 in 1991 that fundamentally changed the way in which Oregon's community colleges were funded. At that time, about 25%, Steve has covered some of this, about 25% of the funding for community colleges came from the state.
Mr. Bender, do you have a correction to make to this?
Oh, just that the actual passage was 1990.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
Implemented in 90.
Right. Yeah.
So the discussion would have reasonably taken place at some point after that.
Yes. As I was saying, the percentage of state resources that supported community colleges prior to the passage of Ballot Measure 5 was about 25%. Today, it is closer to 50%. And over time, just as K-12 consumes a larger and larger share of general funds, I just want it noted that so too have community colleges. Slide number 6 shows you, and this looks familiar because it's a slide that Mr. Bender has prepared, does look at total state revenues, district taxes or property taxes, and tuition, and how over time you can see from 91 to 97, 98, the really drive up of state resources for community colleges and the drive down of district taxes. The funding formula on slide 7. As the state board and staff from the department looked to the future, it was apparent that we would need a new formula. Prior to 1991, we had something that was commonly referred to as floors and caps, and a college couldn't lose more or gain more than a certain percentage. In 1991 and 93, a temporary formula was put into place that did approximately what we're doing now, which was a proportional share of state funds while we sat down and tried to figure out where to from here. And early versions of the formula were adopted in 93, 95. And if you turn to slide 8, it gives you the principles that became the foundation of the funding formula from 95 forward. And those principles are that there should be equity in the distribution of resources. And to Senator Messerly's question, that included both state resources and property taxes. That we did need to needed to provide a base funding so that the infrastructure and school size was taken into account. That we would use property taxes and the state resources to equalize the revenues per student, and that funding would follow the student. So if a college lost enrollment, they would receive less resources, and if they gained students, they would gain funding. These principles are reflected in the formula, and as I mentioned earlier, that formula is currently frozen. Slide 9 talks about the implementation. Within the funding formula, it has remained approximately unchanged since 93-95, and that is that 50% of the property taxes are reflected or are used as a factor in the formula, and the base is included to ensure that there is some operating budget at each college. And full-time equivalent students are the basis for the distribution.
May I ask, with reference to the base factor, can you talk to us a little bit about what the components of that are?
Madam Chair, yes. I'll be real honest. It's a historical artifact. It is based on 1,100 students, and when the formula was when this formula was adopted, that was seen as sort of the tip point of whether you had enough resource to maintain your infrastructure at 1,100. And that's been many years ago, and I believe.
So just a point of clarification then, the base factor is the funding equivalent of 1,100 students?
Madam Chair, if I may, for the record, Brett West, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Community Colleges. The base factor is based on, in this time frame, it was $400 per FTE for the first 1,100 FTE. So any college receiving more than 1,100 serving more than 1,100 FTE would get a flat $440,000, and it was a sliding scale based on their size up to that. Over the last couple of years, we've applied an inflation factor to raise the $440 per FTE to a point where we'll be at $610 per FTE next biennium. And the current formula adds additional factors that increase the base amount for the smallest colleges. So any college above 5,000 FTE gets no additional increase in our base factor, but there's 10 different scales for the smallest up to 5,000. So a college like Oregon Coast with about 450 FTE or so would receive an additional percentage on top of that base factor to come up with their total base funding.
Would you possibly or could you supply the committee with what those adjustments are for the small campuses?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume this is sort of similar to the situation we face in K-12 with maintaining small rural schools, which are more expensive to run than urban schools, which have gains as far as size is concerned. So I think there's some parallels there. Just want to see the results. Funds per FTE, what's the figure of that right now versus this 400 base FTE? We're getting $400 per FTE now into the base funding. What does it work out to, funds per FTE, at the end here with enrollments and, you know, minus the base funding?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Bates, we'll get into that a little later on as we talk about all of the resources per FTE at every college. For this year, if our projections for this year hold, the total that's available statewide per FTE will be about $2,100. We do have a slide on that a little later on so that you can see the calculations over the last several years.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Representative Bates?
I assume the property tax issue is going to be discussed further also. I mean, I can just guess there's big differences, different levy amounts, different mill rates. Some districts may be highly industrialized. Some may have higher value residential, and some have lower value residential. I mean, that's obviously a big factor here where that money's flowing. I assume there'll be a discussion of that later in your presentation. Thank you.
I'm also hoping that the discussion around the local revenue has a component that talks about total dollars rather than just tax rates.
Absolutely.
Further questions or comments? Please proceed.
Slide number 10 provides you a rather simplistic view of how the formula equation operates. At the top, we take the state appropriation plus 50% of the imposed property taxes. That equals a pot of funds that we refer to as total formula funds. We minus from that the base that we have just been discussing. And right now, that base for all the colleges is about $10 million. That then is the pot that is left that we divide total enrollments into. And that's how we arrive at the number that Brett just gave you at 2,100 and change. Now, over time, the base funding has grown from about...
Can I ask for clarification on the equation? So are we then to presume that the remaining 50% of the imposed property taxes stay in the taxing district?
Madam Chair, yes, and for clarity, property taxes never leave the district.
So, okay, but they are not, probably a better way to phrase that then would be the remaining 50% are not involved in the equation.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Slide 11, I have mentioned earlier that the State Board has proceeded with a freeze on enrollments in an effort to stop the erosion of the value of an FTE. In so doing, when they looked at their formula, the chart, the previous chart, they realized that they are likely out of balance because we have 95% of the resources in the current funding formula that follows the student, and about 5% or 6% that provides the base for the institution. And in times like these, and when funding is slowing down and students are slowing down, and the pot stays the same, the dollars in the pot stay the same, what you do is you move funding from one college to the other, depending on how fast College A grew. College B might grow at 2%. College A might grow at 5%. College B still loses money because of the way this formula is.
Just another point of clarification here. Was I correct in, I thought I heard you say that the base funding component is about 5 to 6% of the total funding?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
So our effort is to look at how to better balance, ensure that money still follows the student, but to not make it a exactly, so that the scale doesn't tip quite so dramatically. To that end, the State Board has directed the staff of the agency to work with the Community College President's Council to review and recommend a new formula for 05-07. And you have listed on this slide the presidents who are currently undertaking that particular assignment. I want to make sure that the committee knows, because I mean, probably know where these areas are, but some care was taken by Chair President Channel to ensure that there were small and large, rural and suburban, east side, west side interests served on this particular Council of Presidents Task Force.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The original formula at 50%, was there, do you know the history of that? I mean, how did they come up with the half?
Madam Chair, Representative March, it is a story of lore told many times. It was a compromise It was a compromise of the community college presidents and the leadership then of the office. And it was, as in all compromises, it was not 100% voted for, but it was adopted by the state board and has been used since.
Some wanted all, some wanted none.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Madam Chair and Representative March, I would further say that part of the interest here is recognizing that the passage of Measure 5 and the mandatory nature of service to K-12 students and the inclusion of all property taxes was on the minds of those individuals who built this formula. It was not required that they consider property taxes, but they did choose to.
Maybe a follow-up?
Follow-up?
One of the things, and of course this is getting a little arcane into property tax issues, but some of these districts are probably under a compression while others are not. And do we have some information that you could bring back on that?
Madam Chair, Representative March, we certainly could, but all of them are under compression now. That's my understanding.
Representative March, I think that the other issue that we run into, especially in the rural areas of the state, are that the property valuations are so substantially lower than they are at the top end of the Willamette Valley that a levy that has a substantial rate per thousand doesn't actually raise much money.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I have a question on the slide on page 11, the makeup of the Community College President's Council. What is the process for involving the other community college presidents in defining the future of the funding formula?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it's with some trepidation that I try to represent the President's Council to you. But as I am a member of this particular task force, it is our intention that at every meeting, and the President's Council does meet monthly, that they are given, that we have an exchange and a review of topics that have been covered in our conversation. And it is planned that that will continue. Right now, we have slated to have a recommendation for review by the full President's Council in early August, so that they can really look deeply and be involved in all aspects of the recommendation.
So, in effect, Madam Chair, the recommendation that will go forward will be a recommendation that is endorsed by all of the presidents? That's the hope.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that is the hope.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would imagine, Senator Gordley, that it is somewhat analogous to the situation that we're undergoing in this budget process.
Quite true.
Thank you.
Moving on to slide 12. This slide gets to perhaps the heart of the matter. This list by college. The actual number of that R FTE that you see in the second column is reimbursed full-time equivalent, because we do have some headcounts that we don't reimburse for. The rate per thousand, the property taxes that are imposed by that rate, and a simple division to arrive at the taxes per full-time equivalent by college.
So then, based on the information that you've given us, do we assume that half of the FTE money or half of the total property tax collection money stays in the individual districts and half goes into the distribution formula?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Brett answer this because he is more clear.
Okay.
Madam Chair, when you asked your question earlier in the presentation, I think you hit it right on the head. Half of the property taxes are used in the formula to allocate state funds, but all of the property taxes actually stay with the district. We never actually collect them. It's probably just a technical point, but And it is important, I think, to know that the property taxes never come to Salem, only as an allocator in the formula.
Well, and what I'm trying to get clarity on is the net impact on the individual community colleges. And so what I am asking is, if my understanding of the basic formula is correct, that 50% of the collected taxes would be used by each of these community colleges independently, and 50% would be applied to the funding formula.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And we will show you the impact in the next few slides by including the property taxes in the formula.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. I think that we have, what I would like to point out on slide 12 is our interest as represented by the state board is to do our level best to equalize the amount that a college receives for each student they serve. And in so doing, we almost put on a blinder of what is collected there or not, because we're after distributing approximately the same dollar for every student that is served.
Messerly has a question.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm struggling with that, and I would like a better explanation as to how you came to that position, because ultimately what that means is that regardless of the economy in the community, some districts are going to be paying into the funding of other community colleges, but quite frankly, the economic situation is much different. And it really puts an added burden on some of the communities that are really, really having a rough time and have had for 20 plus years. Is that not part of the discussion or part of the formula?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, the bluntest answer is not particularly in the development of the distribution formula. When you look at the middle column here, the rate per thousand, I would like to point out that there is considerable variation in the rate per thousand. It all depended on the timing of when a college was chartered, when it took a property tax question to its constituents. We run from a high at Treasure Valley of $1.22 a thousand to a low at Oregon Coast of 17.5 cents.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
Isn't the real crux of this problem the tax base that those community colleges had when ballot measure 5 came in, and their inability to address that locally?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, I would say that is a major contributing factor, yes.
Follow up. Then why aren't we dealing with that issue as opposed to putting more burden on some of the communities that are having a tough time?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, if we could join together to figure out a way to deal with that, with the rate at which taxpayers pay per thousand in a more equalized way for community college service, I'll be there.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for taking some tough questions here. I know it's a real conundrum trying to figure this thing out. The figures we have in front of us are a reflection of different values of properties, whether they have an industrial base or residential base, and what that residential base is worth. It can't show what that community's income is, which is, I think, Senator Messerly's concern, and I share that concern. It doesn't show, from my point of view, what I'd really like to know is what's the tax burden on an average household in those districts? That would be meaningful to me. What is the average household in these different districts paying in comparison when you look at the value of the property, the value of industrial base, and you can look at a community and say, what is it really costing for the average taxpayer in their home, head of household, however you want to measure it, what are they paying in actual money into their system? Is that also a taking a factor in how many people live in that district compared to how many students you have going to your community college? And the other question that I'd like to see in the same piece, if we could, is what's the variation in tuition? There must be some reflection of that at each district also. Because that's a reflection of what the formula does. And I think I sense what you're trying to do here, trying to level the playing field out between these hugely different districts, hugely different community colleges, and yet make the college still available to those students that need to go there at a reasonable rate. And that's pretty tricky. And I think that's why you're working on this. But those two figures would help me. And that might be instructional for all of us. Then we could look at our communities and say, how do we stack up to other communities? What's the real cost, not just the mill rate? What's the real cost to a family as far as their burden for taking care of the community college?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates will certainly bring that back.
If we're going to look at that, we probably need to look at the complete picture, though. I mean, because then you're opening it up, the K-12 formula as well. I mean, we equalize the K-12 formula, attempt to equalize that per student as well. So having to look at a global picture rather than micro pictures.
Well, and I think in the larger sense that the committee would be well served by making that comparison. But while we're discussing this budget and trying to come to a resolution on where to be on this budget, I think we should just focus on the immediate issue.
To proceed, the chart. I'm on slide 14. As we've said, no. 13. Beg your pardon. No property tax revenues actually leave the district. Including one half of the local property taxes in the formula does affect the amount of state funds that a community college receives. It absolutely does. And the chart that I was moving to on page 14 does a excellent job of displaying the property tax, the impact on property taxes in the distribution. And this is the 03 based on the projections for 03-05.
Then, again, for clarification, what we're looking at here in the column that's labeled effect of property taxes on state funding, this would be the amount of the offset of property taxes by state funding. I didn't say that very well at all. That if you have a negative number in this column, it means essentially that the state funding that's going into that district is less because the property tax puts them over the equalization number.
Essentially, Madam Chair, that is correct. It does, that negative number means that they receive that much less in state funds because they have more property taxes.
Okay, and then conversely, the numbers that are positive numbers are districts that receive extra state support because their property tax collections don't bring them up to the amount per student.
Yes, Madam Chair. You get it.
Representative Moore.
I'd like to see this chart with another column that shows the total amount of the total amount of dollars per FTE from the state funding, and also one total amount including local funding.
That would be chart number 15.
Okay.
I'm so glad we anticipated your question.
But I'd like to see the numbers that go
with
that.
Yes, absolutely. We will bring those back. Chart 15 does show you when property taxes are a factor in the formula, the lightly shaded box shows you that portion that is property taxes per student and that portion that is state funds per student. For an average, and we can see the line drawn there at 31-35. And I would point out that the relative winners, if you will, are the small colleges. Slide number 16, then, to show you the picture, excludes property taxes from the formula to show you the impact of not factoring in 50% of the property taxes, with the average public support line still drawn.
Do you have one with 100% of the property taxes, since you're you're anticipating one direction? Uh-huh. Let's anticipate both directions.
Questions or comments from the committee? I think we're just trying to process here. So.
Yes.
Put them on two different pages.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Cam, I'm flipping back and forth. You've done a very nice job of putting these on two back-to-back pages. Saved a few trees and given me double vision. I'll go out here with a migraine headache. I don't self-treat. Primarily because I don't trust myself. So I'm going to go to a real doctor. Looking at this, it appears to me, correct me if I'm reading this wrong, and please help me here, if you take out the local property taxes as part of the formula, it appears that the small colleges actually receive more funding. Is that correct? Or is that, I'm just trying to read this, and I'm not sure which of the small colleges, I'm assuming Tillamook Bay and Oregon Coast and Clatsop, mm-hmm. are the smaller colleges. So that if you take that out of the formula, they shift towards the smaller colleges. Is that correct?
I can answer. Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that is correct. By including 50% of the property taxes in the formula, we have high of $4,110 per FTE for Oregon Coast and a low of $2,938 per FTE for Portland. If we exclude the property taxes as a factor, we end up with a high of $4,372 per FTE for Oregon Coast and a low of $2,820 for Umpqua. The range then grows quite a bit more significantly. I didn't do the math before I got here. From $1,300 with the property taxes in the formula to about $1,500 without property taxes in the formula. So the impact is to move the colleges by having property taxes in the formula closer to the middle, though it does have a pronounced impact on the smallest colleges. It is correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
And flipping back and forth between various pages here, it is interesting for me to note that Oregon Coast and Portland have the lowest mill rates per 1,000, both of them do, because we haven't factored in the value of properties, the number of properties versus the number of, it gets very complex here. And so the question I asked earlier, what it's cost each household, it becomes more important for me to evaluate this and kind of understand it better. I would really like to see that last piece put in so I could have a better grasp of what this means for people paying their taxes in the various districts. But if your goal is to maintain opportunity for students in rural areas, so they can stay home and go to college in small communities, then it appears that excluding property tax from the formula pushes it in that direction. If that's the policy goal, which I'm not saying it is. Am I assessing that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I'm coming to a yes and no answer. Yeah.
You're becoming a very good politician.
I would wish to say that you could do one thing and it would provide a positive impact for all colleges. And what we are providing for you is a snapshot. It does not include the tuition. It does not include other elements that are available to a college. But the primary policy stance of the state board is to fund that student no matter where they are in the state so that they do have opportunity.
Madam Chair, you anticipated my very next question, and I'm just trying to get a snapshot so I can start getting a feel for this. Do you happen to know what the tuition cost is at Oregon Coast and what the tuition cost at Portland is?
Well,
I
don't have it in the presentation.
But I have the presidents here. $47 at Oregon Coast.
Is that for?
$45 at Portland.
Thank you.
So when you get all through with this, the tuition at the two institutions is very similar. Thank you.
Senator Mesley.
I believe that is equalized now, but when this formula first started, Representative, those colleges who were hurt by the formula raised their tuition much sooner than those did now, and the reason they've equalized now is because of the drop in state support. That's my understanding. I could be corrected, but so when this first, when we first saw the formula take effect, the community colleges that, again, were negatively impacted raised their tuition first. So that's not really a true picture, I don't think, what you just got.
The net result right now is there, but there had to be a big tuition increase. It doesn't take into account also that families in certain areas probably have less income to support that tuition increase, and we still don't know what the average household is paying on tax break.
Might be too simplistic.
What?
Might be too simplistic.
No, I think the information that you're introducing is good information. Senator Mesley, did you have any follow-up comments?
Well, are we about done with talking about the formula? I do, if we are, and I think we are. Madam Chair, I'm not sure we've had all of the questions answered that I raised yesterday. For instance, I'd like to see a graph of exactly who are the community colleges that win, how much, and what percentage of their gain by the formula is of their total budget.
Does the
in the same way on the losses?
Does the display on page 14 answer your first question?
Well, I don't think so. Unless I'm totally reading this wrong. It does not show the percentage of the budget, is one of the questions. And there was, and this is showing more people, more community colleges that gain than what I was, what was my understanding. So, I'm not sure why the information is not matching. The percent change, is that what the formula sent? This is only from 2003-5, isn't it? I guess I just need to spend more time with this. I just wanted a list of who wins, who loses, and what that, how much that impact is.
But you want it spread over more time than just 0305?
Well, I think you have to start with 0305, but I'd like to know the impact over time as well. And in fairness, I did not clarify that yesterday. I think yesterday I was probably asking simply on the 0305.
Mm-hmm. Senator Mesley, would you like to talk to these folks after the session to make sure that you're clear on what your information needs are?
Yes, I do. I mean, the information is probably here, but it, to me, it's not really laid out very clearly.
Okay.
It's hard to pull it out.
And were there? Did you want to raise any points right now about the rest of the information requests, or do you want to cover that?
I think separately. No, I think I'm fine.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have said this in previous hearings with regards to the community college funding formula, and it may sound trite, but it would be our day-in, day-in conversation, and that is that there seems to be no perfect formula.
Can I ask just for one more point of clarification? You have a work group working on the funding formula, and are we correct in assuming then that in the next legislative session we will be hearing the results of that discussion?
Madam Chair, I would expect so, yes.
And can you talk to us about what the impacts are on the lawsuit of this process?
Madam Chair, I'm not certain I understand
your
question.
Well, we understand that there's a lawsuit around this issue.
That's correct.
The question is, in terms of where that lawsuit is going, how will this process factor into that?
Madam Chair, I see them as somewhat parallel.
Okay.
Tracks. The lawsuit is proceeding. I would expect that we have perhaps 6 to 12 months before we have a response to that. I think that the President's Council work group or task force that's working on financing for the 05-07 biennium is cognizant that that is a factor, but they will, I think, do not feel constrained in their thinking about what they want for the future. I hope that's an adequate conversation. We aren't putting anything on hold while we wait for the lawsuit to come to a conclusion.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, slide 17, there was a request from Representative Bates to have a look at a comparison between the other education sectors, primarily the university system and K-12, to these different factors. So slide 12 just gives you a very brief snapshot of things you probably already know, since you have talked about the school fund and the university system was before us. But just to remind you that property taxes are 50% a factor in the community college formula. No property taxes go to the university system, and 100% of the property taxes are included in the K-12 formula. And I would continue, but only if you have additional questions. Okay. Moving on then, we want to move now to a conversation about the agency's Community College Support Fund request. We wanted to take just a brief minute to talk about historically how the budget request has come to the legislature and the governor. It had been what a current service plus inflation budget request in the past. It did not reflect increases in student enrollment, and there was very little connection between the dollar amount that was requested and the average cost of serving a student. Our approach in the 2001 session was to change our request so that it was based on a projection of the students that we anticipated we would serve.
Cam, if I might interject, you have three presidents here who probably can't return, and I would hate to not give them the time to talk to us, so I'm wondering if there is a reasonable place to break this so we can allow those folks to come forward and talk and then continue this presentation next week.
Madam Chair, about two more slides,
okay,
if we might. to continue, our budget request is based on, again, a conservative projection of who we think we will serve. So we aren't always in a catch-up mode. And we base it on the statewide average of the actual cost of serving a student. That cost is derived, and we went into some particular detail when we built this funding model. It's based on national reporting of Oregon schools, of Oregon Community College, on their revenue and expenditure reports. And we gather that statewide data and provide an average. A review of our 2001 appropriation is that we did leave the session with $464 million, and we were expecting to serve 192,000 students a year. No, that's an FTE. That's a biennial figure. Sorry. At the conclusion of the 2001 session, the legislature was funding about 45.9% of the average cost of a student. Since we have left the 2001 session, $32 million of the $45 million was disappropriated because of budget reductions. The request for this year is on slide 21. The average cost per student at 45% of the projected cost, the state share would be $2,483 a student. That does not include inflation. We've multiplied that by our expected number of students that would be served, and that's a 3% increase per year. That made our budget request a little over $500 million. Slide 22 talks about the reality of the enrollment scenarios as we look at a budget request that was submitted prior to the current economic forecast. This is a slide you've seen. It has been provided by Mr. Bender before. And I just wanted to make sure and highlight for the committee that we moved from a high of serving 97,000 students in 2001 when we had an increase in funds to, at the finish of 2005, depending on level of funding, either 80,000 students or a top of 90,000 students. And with that, I would like to ask Rick Levine, president at Rogue Community College, to join me.
Welcome, President Levine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Levine. I'm the president at Rogue Community College in Southern Oregon. I'd like to talk to you about two things that are primarily the same but a little bit different. The first part of my discussion is around the ramifications of the five special sessions as well as the governor's budget and how that is changing the educational policy of the state of Oregon. And it very definitely is, and I'd like to go into just a little bit of detail. As we make decisions to reduce our budget, we have to take a look at a variety of different factors. You've heard through the funding formula that we've got three major sources of revenue: property taxes, tuition, and the state reimbursement. When we take a look at how our budgets are derived, we look at all of our programs on how many students are enrolled, and we look at what those programs cost us. A lot of the colleges, we're trying to put together the total number of college programs, have started to reduce their professional technical programs. These are our most expensive programs. As an example, we have stopped enrollments in our respiratory therapy program. That program is budgeted at $240,000 per year, and it trains between 12 and 16 students. It's a very expensive program, but every one of those students goes to work. That $240,000, if we were to use that for our lower division transfer programs, converts into 120 sections of approximately an average size class of about 25. So when we take a look at how we deal with our budget shortfalls, we take a look at program expenses. On the other side of the equation, we also take a look at where we're getting our revenue from for particular populations. And when you look at adult basic education, developmental education, English as a second language education, a lot of those courses are non-tuition bearing courses. We get some federal funds to help offset the cost of those courses, but they don't pay the same amount of dollars in tuition revenue that our lower division programs do or our professional technical programs do. So there's two ends of the spectrum that are always in jeopardy. One, because we don't receive enough revenue and tuition from a set of students, and the other because the programs are quite expensive. As we went through the five special sessions and looked at the governor's budget, we were seeing huge losses in the amount of state revenues that we were going to see, and also at the same time huge increases in tuition. Most of the colleges have chosen, and I'll go into a little detail as to what our rural community colleges do, is to try to figure out how we do not impact all of those segments I just mentioned disproportionately. Because both of those areas, when you're talking about developmental skills and when you're talking about professional technical programs, attract people from lower income households. For an example of that is our nursing programs. Our nursing programs typically are women. Typically, they are single women with one or two children. They are trying to get an education in one of the most difficult program areas that a community college has. And if they were to pay more for that program, or as some would call it, a differentiated tuition, they would not be able to go to school. They also, in many cases, lack certain skills that they need that they find in our developmental education program to get them ready for the nursing program. So if we were to impact those areas, we would find that we would be losing lower income students because of a variety of different factors. What I would say, when we go through our budget processes and we take a look at that, that the educational policy that is being formulated because of this reduction is one that changes the mission that you saw at the beginning of this hearing. And at the end of my talk, I will try to paraphrase what I would believe in the next few years our mission might become unless the legislature is able to do something about the funding levels to community colleges. But our statutory mission that you heard includes being a comprehensive, community college. And the reality is, when we start shrinking down those two segments, our basic skill segments, our professional technical segments, we become junior colleges rather than community colleges. And we become a feeder institution for the local universities, public universities in particular, that are in our geographic areas, and ours at Southern Oregon University. Whether that's a good thing or a negative issue, it will begin to impact those students who are trying to get into the workforce, who are trying to seek a technical career, or simply trying, as we do with our welfare reform projects and jobs programs, trying to get their educational level to a point where they can even hold a job that provides them with a minimum wage. Those programs start to go away, and what we're left with is the transfer programs that we've got. Now, why would that be advantageous to a community college to do that? Well, when you're looking at transfer programs, just as the university does, when you take a look at their programs in writing, social science, and history, you're paying for an instructor to teach a class. Those class sizes can be anywhere from 25 to 50. In some cases, they could be 80 to 100 students in a class. And they're extremely cost-effective. It's a challenge not to look at that as a way to deal with the budget problems that we currently have. because you can very honestly survive by becoming a transfer institution. But that's not what our mission is. That's not what the statutory mission is, and that's not what the expectation is from our local communities. Our local communities expect us to train a workforce and expecting to have individuals who can go into jobs that are minimum wage and jobs that are higher wage. And I keep changing the screen on you as I reflect on, hopefully that's not too distracting. My notes are on the computer. What I'm trying to say is in the next, I would say, two bienniums, if things do not change, we will have no choice but to shrink down the numbers of programs, technical programs we have, and how we deal with low-income people who don't have the skills to get into programs. Now, the governor's projected budget for Rogue Community College, to be more specific, I want to tell you what we're doing. Because I think it's a value for you to understand that we've taken the governor's message to heart. The governor said we should be freezing all salaries. We have two of our three, I'll call them unions, they'll call themselves associations, have agreed to a zero-cost increase for next year. We have already capped about 5 or 6 years ago our insurance coverage so that there's a 6% cap. They'll be picking up more of that. They've also agreed to a 10-day reduction in how many days they work, which further reduces our payroll costs. And we're fairly close with the third group in being able to get them to agree to something very similar. So that was one of the ways that we took a look at how do we reduce our particular deficit, which, by the way, in fiscal year 04 was $2.2 million, and in 05 it's $3.5 million. We looked at how to reduce the deficit for both years of the biennium. We have increased tuition. Our tuition is going from $49 a credit to $59 a credit. We've also doubled the amount of fees that we have, and those fees will go to another $8 a credit, which in effect means that students will be paid, I get my math, will be paying in tuition $67 a credit. We're not going to be the highest because I've heard other community colleges are doing the same. At one point, we were at $45 a credit, and before that, we were at $40 a credit, and that was not too long ago. That was all within a five-year period. So you can see we've increased our tuition dramatically. That brings us about $1 million in. We've eliminated our respiratory therapy program, 9.5 full-time positions for next year. We're looking at 10 positions for the following year. Altogether, we will reduce our capacity to deliver services, our access, by approximately, in full-time equivalency terms, close to 10%. That's 450 FTE, which equates, we have about 3.5 students to each FTE. We will probably reduce access to over 1,200 students as a result of this budget. We do not know how that increase in tuition will affect students. We might see even lower enrollments because of that high tuition increase. So that's our plan. We've taken there are within that full-time equivalency reduction other program cuts that I haven't mentioned because I know I'm sharing this time with two of my other colleagues. I did rewrite, took the opportunity as I was sitting there listening to Cam. And unfortunately, now I cannot see it very well because the light is different. But basically, if you took the four paragraphs in the mission, and Cam is graciously letting me look at it, I would say that within the next two bienniums, we'll have a community college that is an educational institution intended to fill the institutional gap in education by offering academic subjects. Period. It will be primarily designed to provide associate degree programs for students who will continue on to their baccalaureate degree. Period. It will provide a means for continuing of academic education. Period. That is what we'll be able to afford to do as we project out our budgets over the next two bienniums. That is not what I believe you want us to do but what our community wants us to do. But it is an issue of just pure economics. This is my 30th year in community college education. I've been in front of committees such as this for 15 different times. It is not what you want us to do. You want us to be a full, comprehensive community college serving all of our communities, being able to provide them with education at a variety of different levels, being able to provide them with the opportunity to go to work. The governor's budget, the five special sessions have severely hampered how we do that and have now put more of the burden on our students to provide the wherewithal to go to college than ever before. I think that what's going to happen in this state, if it continues, is that it'll be very difficult to attract new companies to the state because there will not be institutions who can provide the training for that new workforce. Thank you.
The question I want to ask you, during the interim when we were doing our rebalances to subsequent lower revenue forecasts, one of the things that we did was to we took a cut in community college support and sent some instructions that this was to be used to offset the support to the personal development type classes. Could you talk to the committee about what the impact was at Rogue of doing that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rogue Community College has very few community education classes that are reimbursed by the college. We were affected about $100,000 in lost revenue. We consider that to be a small amount in consideration for what the legislature wanted us to do. Most of our programs in that area tended to be workforce and health-related public safety programs. So we did not have an impact. It was not a large impact on our college. All of those courses are now have been moved over, as the commissioner has said, to self-support, anything that is not directly related to workforce or public safety. So we did not have a huge impact, and it's not made a huge impact. Representative March did ask if that had made an impact on our enrollments. That has not. What has, to address that for a second, is we have closed four facilities that provided basic skills for students. That has made the difference in our decrease in enrollment, because that particular group of people, low-income people, don't move through the transportation system in a rural area very well. And so they choose not to go to school if they can't afford to get to school.
So, President Levine, is it a true statement that when you talk about the community interest classes, I believe you call them, are those supported entirely by tuition?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that for Rogue Community College, that is entirely true.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
President Richard Levine, thank you for coming today. I'll remember to call you Richard in the future. Thank you for coming. It's a long drive up here. You're one of my constituents, and I appreciate your testimony. I would like to share with this panel just very quickly a story which I think illustrates what you do and what your college does. 3.5 years ago, a young lady I know very well came to you. And,
would you make this a short story? We still have two questions.
I will simply say that she went to you with no education, single mother, got her GED, got her nursing degree, got off TANF, got off welfare, and is now working, making $45,000 a year as a nurse.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time that you've taken to talk to me through your budget process, too. That was a great learning experience for me.
Madam Chair, I would like to have President Jess Carrion join me now. I feel like Diana.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very, very much for the opportunity. You have in front of you,
thank you.
Testimony that I provided for you, so I'm not going to show any disrespect by reading this to you, because I'm assuming you can read it. But I will highlight a couple of areas which I think are really crucial.
Excuse me, for the record, could you identify yourself?
Dr. Jess Garion, Portland Community College. I'm the president, at least the last time I checked. Many of the things that Rick Levine pointed out are occurring in Portland. So, you know, I won't go through the litany of the kinds of things that are impacting us. Our dilemma is just somewhat bigger. First year I was there, we cut $2.7 million. This year we cut $5.6 million, and we're looking at a $20 million hole. PERS handed us a gift of $4.7 million. So beginning July 1, before I start spending anything else, I have to budget for a $4.7 million PERS liability. I think those things are really important to remember. Our tuition is going up from $45 to $58, as well as other fees. I think all of my colleagues are suffering through this in terms of having to raise tuition and fees for their students. We're cutting out 32 programs, professional technical programs in some cases, but I'm being very careful. Looking at a balance of across the board reductions in a variety of areas, because my vision is not to directly attack or reduce professional technical programs only. And I refuse to become just a junior college. So we're going to do our best to maintain a comprehensive program as best we possibly can. And I think that's the responsibility that I have as president of the college to the community. We're reorganizing our basic skills and our basic education program completely. Not cutting it, but we're completely redesigning it to be more efficient and more effective in how we deliver programs and services to that population, which is growing and is not predominantly white. It is predominantly in the area of Portland, it's becoming more and more people of color, but not only Hispanics and African Americans, but also people coming in from Eastern European countries in southeastern Portland. Our population is becoming extremely diverse, and it is a responsibility for us, because they will get AA degrees and move on, but they will start with basic skills and remediation. And as Dr. Bob McCabe wrote in his book on remediation, remediation is a key, ultimately, to people getting the AA degree. So basic skills, as my colleague Rick mentioned, is really crucial to us, as are our nursing programs. We're aggressively moving to work with business and industry, to work with the federal government, to bring in grants, to do a lot of things which, in my opinion, we have to do. I think, and again, we reduce positions. We reduce 44 positions at the college. But let me address what I think perhaps is a bigger issue. And again, everything is here that you can read, and it's I think it's pretty straightforward. And I didn't want to bore you with page and page upon page of a lot of detail. But it's the same thing that I presented to the media. Tonight we have another board meeting, which we're presenting this final proposed budget to the board. But I think the issue of the funding formula is really important. And we can change the funding formula every day. And we can nickel and dime it and tweak it today, Tuesday, a week from Friday. The funding formula will never work ultimately until the public policy decision of how K-16 public education fits within the vision of this state. That's not the role of the president. That's not the role of CAM. That's the role of the governor and the legislature. We can't affect that. So the legislature has to come to grips with K-16 and what our role is in the economic vision of this state. Once that's decided, then how are we going to be funded? And then a strategy which determines the appropriate funding level for each sector. Clearly K-12 is important, and it's devastating in my mind. It hurts, because I taught in K-12, to see what's happening to those K-12s. And I'm not just talking about Portland. I'm talking about the rural schools, as Representative Bates pointed out. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room in those rural K-6 and K-12 districts. Same thing is happening at the four-year schools. We need to build world-class universities, and they're struggling. And the community colleges that put people back to work, that are transforming America, we're the ones that create wealth. because we are the ones that have a direct impact on a day-to-day basis on those people who are working or need to be reemployed, or these people who want to move on, like Representative Bates and like myself, who have an AA, get an AA degree, get a BA degree, and go on to become professionals. I'm also a community college graduate, so I walk the walk and talk the talk. But the bottom line is, I really think it's really a good idea, and I think it was instructive for you to understand the funding formula. But ultimately, that is the responsibility of the president. Ultimately, the legislature has to deal with the big public policy issues, and that's where we need your help. We desperately need your help to come up with a vision between you and the governor on where K-16 is within the vision of an economic strategy, and then adopt an approach to fund us appropriately, and then the strategy. Redo the tax structure. God knows people hate that word, but the bottom line is, when you have increasing population, when you have populations that need more services, when the population is becoming more diverse, when the workforce needs more training, and your costs are rising, the two lines are separating each other. If Oregon is going to move into the 21st century leading rather than following, then the legislature and the governor, I think, need to step up to the plate, and we need your help. But we will be there fighting as hard for you and supporting the kind of things that you do, because these 17 presidents and their boards, you know, whether they're rural or urban or suburban, support Oregon of the 21st century. Everyone in this state needs the opportunity to succeed. And ultimately, my job, Madam Chair, members of the board, is not as a president of a college, it's not as an educator, but it's my job is ultimately to improve the quality of life in the communities that we serve, of all Oregonians. Thank you.
Questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. To President Carrion, would just like to say thank you. I appreciate your leadership. Appreciate your message, and I hope that we find our way to internalize the message that you have delivered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee.
Madam Chair, I would now like to ask President Mary Spieldy from Lane Community College to join me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Spieldy, president of Lane Community College. What I'd like to do very briefly is just tell you the impact on Lane Community College of the revenue shortfalls, and then talk to you a little bit about some of the challenges and considerations that we have to face as we're making these very difficult decisions right now. Coming into this year, Lane Community College had a deficit of $7.25 million, almost 10% of our budget. Last year, we went through a very detailed process and ended up reducing our budget by $5 million. We closed 7 professional technical programs. We reduced 2 or 3 other professional technical programs. We closed our adult high school, our court school, and we laid off 40 staff, faculty, managers, and classified staff. We also increased tuition by 27% to balance our budget. Looking at this coming year, we have a deficit of over $7 million. $3.3 million of that $7 million is the PERS system. We have done everything we can to contain costs. We've been doing that for a number of years at Lane. We're trying to think about how we can work smarter and not harder to use our resources as effectively as we can. And frankly, we believe we're about as efficient as we can get in the use of those resources. Just one example. Last year, we brought all of our employee groups and unions to the table and asked them to look at our healthcare costs. And through a collaborative process, we moved all of our employees onto one insurance plan. That saved the college $1.5 million this year. However, that money is directly coming out of the pockets of our employees because they're paying more at point of service, their premiums are higher, and so forth. So while the college is a winner in that regard, we're certainly hearing from our employees about the increased cost to them as individuals. And the beat goes on with that because we're hearing from this new insurance plan that our costs next year will be another 20 to 25% increase. The challenges that I see for us, our 80% of our costs are personnel. Obviously, in education, we are all about people. health care costs I've mentioned, the PERS system, needed investment in plant. We need to protect the investment that the community has made in our college. We need money for equipment replacement so that students can train on the kinds of equipment that they will find when they go to work. We need to build in quality. As Rick mentioned, there's this increasing demand for transfer, which is very easy for us to do. But if we move in that direction, we will become a junior college. And particularly in the Eugene area, it's very easy for us to continue to provide transfer because we just cannot meet the demand. But we do have a commitment to our mission of professional technical. But when you recognize that for a personal enrichment course, it costs us at Lane about $756 per full-time equivalent student. For a transfer course like psychology, it costs about $1,700 per full-time equivalent student. For a developmental remedial class, it's about $3,200 per full-time equivalent student. And for a professional technical program like nursing or dental hygiene, it's $8,756 per full-time equivalent student. Last year when we made cuts, our community said, don't cut professional technical programs. That's why we want you here. But the reality is that from a financial perspective, we would cut professional technical programs and only do transfer and personal enrichment because that's what provides the revenue stream for us to support the more expensive programs. So when, for us, when the personal enrichment courses were not funded this year, that didn't really help us in the sense that that was partially a revenue stream to support those more expensive programs, and that really is contributing to our deficit this year. So the biggest challenge then is how do we balance across the mission given these financial realities, and that's certainly something that we have been dealing with at Lane. For the year coming up, we have decided that we are not going to cut professional technical programs next year. Our community expects us to offer these programs, and at a time when the economy is still slowing down, last week we had Sony close with a 277 layoff of staff. We don't see that it makes any sense for us to pull back at this time in these programs that directly move people into work, and in many cases, very high demand work. So next year, we are increasing tuition another 27%. In 2 years, we will have gone from $38 a credit to $62 a credit, and with more coming if we see more cuts from the legislature. We're implementing differential pricing. That is, for our more expensive programs, particularly the professional technical programs, we will be charging increased fees for those programs relative to the number of hours that students sit in a classroom. So, for example, in our nursing program, it will cost, in addition to the $62 per credit, it will cost an additional around $2,000 per year for a student to be in the nursing program. The same for dental hygiene, aviation maintenance, and go on down the list. We're moving our summer school to self-support. In addition to that, we're also cutting a little over $2 million in programs by not filling positions, not replacing retirements, and again, saving every place we can. The impact that I see from all of this, I think Rick covered it pretty well. There will be the temptation to abandon our comprehensive mission, even although our board and the administration is committed to that mission. We see that there will be increasing pressure to become a junior college. Many students with these increases in tuition are simply going to be priced out of the higher education. And I think the biggest concern that I see is that community colleges were created to provide access for the socially and economically disadvantaged. And if we are pricing ourselves to the point where the socially economically disadvantaged cannot afford to come to community colleges, then what sector of higher education is going to be there for them? I don't think there is going to be one. And so this avenue that has been available for people to move off of public assistance to to keep them educated and in the workforce is no longer going to be open for many people. And we're hearing that from our students with the increase that we had this year. As we move into next year and go through our tuition hearings, we know that we're going to hear from students that they can no longer afford to access a higher education. And I believe that that's an issue of public policy and state policy about how are we going to make sure that community colleges are still going to be there to provide access for our lowest income students. And I think the last point I'd like to make is that this issue of access to a wide range of programs that our community expects us to have, and affordability and quality are inextricably linked. If we don't have the range of programs that our community has come to expect, then we hear from businesses that they don't get the educated workforce that they need. But if we have the wide range of programs, then we have to impact affordability. We have to increase tuition in order to continue the access. If we don't deal with the access or affordability issue, then it begins to affect quality. And in the case of our board, we have decided that we are no longer going to erode quality, that we're not going to thin the soup, that whatever we do, we're going to do well. And if that means increased tuition or cutting programs, then that's what we'll do. And so we're about to embark on a major planning process with our community for next year to decide which programs we're not going to have and what is the threshold beyond which we can't increase tuition. Thank you for your time.
Questions or comments from the committee? Outstanding testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I also would like to thank you, President Spill, for the time that you took to talk to me individually on this, what you're going through and your budgeting processes at Lane. I really want to thank all the presidents that you have very busy schedules and huge tasks that you have to deal with, and I thank you for coming here today and talking to the members of the committee about how you're dealing with these challenges on your campuses. We have run out of time. I'm going to close the public hearing for today on House Bill 5009. Mr. Bender, can you talk a little bit to the committee about what we're up to next week?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Next week, you will continue the presentation on the Community College Support Fund on Monday. Then on Tuesday, which will be the final day scheduled on this budget, you will be hearing public testimony relating to this budget. And then you will start the budgets on Wednesday and Thursday, continuing the following week, of the Department of Education operation and grant program.
Thank you. And with that, I'll adjourn this meeting. We'll reconvene at 8:30 on Monday morning.